Again, welcome. We are privileged tonight to have Dr. John Oldham talking to us about DSM-5, and also want to let people know that Dr. Oldham has offered to host a special call-in this Wednesday night from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. in light of the tragedy that has happened, and we will have several people joining Dr. John Oldham on a really just a call-in and a discussion about what's happened and trying to educate people and see what else might people's concerns and questions. So it's now my privilege to turn over this evening's call to Dr. John Oldham. And Dr. Oldham, anything that you would like to add about Friday's tragedy and what we hope to do on our Wednesday night call, please feel free to do that.
Thanks, Perry. I mean, it's very difficult to jump into any topic these days without being preoccupied with that terrible tragedy that happened. And we thought about it and thought about talking about it a little tonight, but then decided it just might be better to try and devote an hour just to an open discussion about that, since it's such an enormously important and stressful situation for everybody. So I think we'll hold any discussion of that at this point until Wednesday, when we can really have an open discussion and hopefully have lots of participation from people joining in. So I will go ahead then with the presentation, and this is the first time I've done this, so I understand that everybody will have a copy on email of the PowerPoints that I'm going to be walking us through. So I will go ahead and proceed, and I can refer to the number of the PowerPoint slide along the way in case people are following along. But what I'm going to be talking about is personality disorders and the long process of thinking about them as we have worked on material to incorporate into the next edition of the Diagnostic Manual, DSM-5. Just to start with the end of the line story, the DSM-5, as I think most of you may know, has been approved by the Board of Trustees and is in the process of being finalized for print now. It will be available at the May meeting of the American Psychiatric Association in May 2013 in San Francisco. So that's the timetable. I've been a member of the Personality and Personality Disorders work group for this entire process. That work group was formed around 2006. But a lot of thinking had been gone into how we ought to think about personality disorders since the early discussions about DSM-5 itself. And so the first slide is a quote from a little monograph book that was published by the APA called The Research Agenda for DSM-5. And this is co-authored by a number of people you can see, including Michael First, who's been a consultant for DSM-4 and also is for DSM-5. And other people like John Crystal from Yale, a number of other very active people in this area like Tracy Shea and Tom Whitaker. And the point here is that right off the bat, there have been many different groups recognizing, and the quote here says it, personality and related relational disorders are very common in outpatient practice. But the system in DSM-4 is, they say, woefully inadequate in really allowing us to facilitate communication among clinicians and manage patients clinically. So we use the system of DSM-4, it's called a categorical system, where we have a set of 10 diagnoses to personality disorders. And each has a set of criteria, it's called a polystatic system, where you have X out of Y required to make the diagnosis. And so it could be any, like for borderline, any 5 out of 9. That makes for a fairly broad universe of types of patients. And I'll say more about that in a minute. But here's another quote from that same volume, and this is by people including Renato Alarcon, who's a member of our group, and Ken Kindler, who is a well-known scientist at Medical College of Virginia. And we'll come back to him because he's been serving a very important function for the APA as chairing the Scientific Review Committee, that's a peer review group that's been looking at DSM-5. But they said in the same early 2002 publication that clinicians and researchers really think that personality is best represented dimensionally. Now, just so everybody is clear, what the simple way is to think about dimensions versus categories. Categories are like specific illnesses or diseases that are very different from each other. So if you get something like pneumonia, it's in the broad category of an infectious disease. It will be a specific illness that is caused by an infectious agent, and then when treated or naturally resolving, it then goes away. So a disorder is generally something that has an onset and has either a chronic condition or comes to a resolution. Dimensionality, and disorders are much more commonly the language we use in the field of medicine. But dimensions, good concepts of dimensions are things like weight and height. They're continuous. There's no sort of gap along the gradient or along the spectrum. So personality is like that. A good way to think of it is like hypertension. You've got to have blood pressure. Each of us has a personality. But maybe too much of it can be a problem and can backfire. And that's a fairly reasonable way to think about it. So for a long time, it's been recognized that a dimensional approach would be a better way to think about personality. And the same from personality types and styles into the extremes of the disorders would then be easier to conceptualize. Tom Whittaker and Eric Simonson published another volume called Dimensional Models of Personality Disorders that's derived from a series of conferences that were held early on. Again, saying that the limitations of the categorical model are pretty well recognized. Well, you're familiar with this, but this is the ESM-4 categorical model. I labeled it at the top of the slide a dimensionally flavored categorical system. And all I meant by that was that these disorder categories are clustered together in three different groups. One called the cluster characterized by kind of oddness, eccentricity, idiosyncratic type of behavior. Cluster B is dramatic, emotional, impulsive, and they all kind of go together. And cluster C is the anxious, fearful groups that are really commonly characterized by high levels of anxiety. What you're seeing here, and what I meant by dimensionally flavored, these descriptions in parentheses are really kind of like what later you'll hear me call trait domains, which is major areas of types and traits of behavior and individual differences that we collect together under one broad umbrella. And that's the way we've tried to rethink the personality disorder section, and I'll show you that in much more detail as we go along. A dimensional representation has been preferred. A lot of people among the earlier literature have talked about the problems with DSM-4 and the categorical system we have. This lists just a few of them. I'm on slide number 6 here. There's things like excessive co-occurrence of disorders, a lot of heterogeneity within categories, sort of arbitrary distinctions between normal and abnormal traits. And really, in spite of having 10 different categories, doesn't really adequately cover the wide variety of personality pathologies that one can see in clinical work. On the other hand, it has not been easy to get a consensus in the dimensional world, and psychology and psychology researchers have been studying the whole area of personality psychology for a long time. There's an enormous database in the area of what's called trait psychology, and using factor analytic methods to study combinations of traits. And one of the sort of most fundamental ones that cover the waterfront to describe human behavior. But there's been a lot of sort of discussion and difficulty achieving a consensus about what the single best dimensional system would be. And that's something we wrestled with a lot in our work group. I'm now on slide number 7.
John, can I just stop you for a minute? Can you talk a little louder, or can the phone be closer to you? I just got an email from someone who's having trouble hearing you.
I will do my best, and that's my voice never carries very well, so let me try to talk more loudly. And please email if you can't hear me, but I'll try to speak it up a little bit. I hope that's a little better.
It is, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay, so I'm on slide number 7, and this is a recent publication in the October issue of the Journal of Personality Disorders. And this was a survey that was done of the members of the International Society for the Study of Personality Disorders. And in this publication, the fairly recent one, again, there was a clear statement that this little question of the system has had a lot of problems with it. Well, let me shift to borderline for a minute, and just I'll use that as an example, and I will come back to it later. So this is my shorthand list of the 9 criteria for borderline personality disorder along the lines of DSM-IV requirements. And again, I said that the DSM-IV is set up with a polyphasic system. In this case, any 5 out of 9 of these criteria must be present for you to get the diagnosis. So one of the problems with that is that it leads to a lot of heterogeneity. Since it's any 5 out of the 9, if you do the math, actually there are 256 different ways you can be diagnosed borderline by DSM-IV. And we've learned that it's, the more we've thought about it and studied it, it's really a hybrid, a kind of mixture of environment-reactive, unstable, stress-induced symptoms and stable personality characteristics, and those are what we call the dimensional traits. And we believe that those are more fundamental in defining the disorder rather than the behaviors that result from those traits. Okay, we're going to get back to borderline in a few minutes, but now I'm moving to the DSM-5 process, and I'm on slide number 10, and this shows the sequence of some of the main events that have happened over time. We started back even over 10 years ago, and there were many collaborative conferences with the National Institute of Mental Health, the World Health Organization, and the task forces, and after a lot of effort to be sure that we made sure nobody had significant conflicts of interest who participated in the process, the work groups were convened around between 2005-2006. And that's when my work group for personality disorders, which is chaired by Andy Skodal, was put together. There were some monographs that were published, and I showed you some quotes from one of those a couple of years later, and those kept coming out over the following few years. And then in 2009, the diagnostic criteria were being drafted, and the field trial for the DSM-5 was subsequently then launched shortly, late 2010, early 2011. The criteria were then revised, and the results of the field trials were incorporated. You see on the bottom right box the creation of something called the Scientific Review Committee. And this is a committee that is chaired by Ken Kendler and co-chaired by Bob Friedman, who's the editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry. It has a group of experts on it and serves really as a kind of a peer review committee. And they've been looking at the published literature to see what publications there have been that would be relevant in terms of the validity of proposed changes. And then they've been kind of ranking the literature strength or lack of it for the proposed changes for all changes in DSM, including the personality disorder section. And this is an advisory group. It's not a decision-making group, but it's been helpful in providing advice about that particular question. What's not on this slide, because this slide was made before we created a second group that's called the Clinical and Public Health Committee, and that's one chaired by Jack McIntyre, who's a former president of the APA, and Joel Yeager, who's head of our evidence-based practice guidelines effort. And that group, in addition, is reviewing some of the proposed changes and particularly those that wouldn't necessarily have been studied extensively and published in the literature. So the sequence of events has been to produce the work group's recommendations, have the task force of the APA all consider those recommendations. And the task force means the collection of all the work group heads together. So it'd be things like Jan Fawcett, who's head of the mood disorders work group, and Danny Pine, who's head of the neurodevelopmental childhood developmental disorders, and Kathy Phillips, who's head of the anxiety disorders, and all of the others, Will Carpenter for psychoses. So all of the work group chairs together comprise the task force, and then they consider the work group's recommendations. Once they are comfortable with them, then it's referred to the scientific review committee. They review the literature, get their advisory report back, and most of the time, many of these proposed changes will then also go to the clinical and public health committee, and they will get their advice back. There's a third committee, which is the committee of the American Psychiatric Association Assembly, and that looks at them as well. Then it comes back to the Board of Trustees, first to its executive committee, and a group that comprises the leaders of the executive committee and these other peer review groups. And all of them look at it again, and then finally it goes to the Board of Trustees for decision. And that culminated in the final approval by the board on December 1st of the entire DSM. So it's a long process with a lot of experts and a lot of work. One of the things that was unique this year, or not this year, but this time for DSM-5 that did not happen before, was a public website with draft proposed changes posted on that website, DSM-5.org. And in 2010, the first set of draft proposals was published on the website, and there were almost 9,000 comments that came in, and these were all reviewed and looked at. I personally reviewed all the comments that came in about borderline personality disorder, and we considered them all carefully. A second posting occurred in 2011, and here many, many visits. You can see the numbers on the slide. I'm on slide number 12. One thing that was interesting is that visits came from 187 countries, and so when you think about this as a volume for the U.S., which is what it is a really an internationally highly relevant publication and also document. The third and final posting was in May of 2012 this year, and again, we had a large international interest in that final posting. And all of the responses, again, were reviewed by the different groups. So this is another quote. This is from a recent publication, 2012, by Ken Kendler and a colleague, that just really talks about the same challenge that we've been wrestling with. And you can see here, he says, our approach to modifying disorders is like small steps, sort of repetitive evolutionary process. But he says maybe the place we started with some diagnoses is kind of like a box canyon. Small changes won't work, and we need a big redesign. And he says, or they say, according to some experts, that's the position in which the personality disorders in DSM-5 find themselves. So, again, there's been a consistent review that we need to move towards something dimensional. Now, the work group was put together, and the members of the work group are shown in this slide. Andy Skodel was chair. I was later asked to be co-chair, and got some very good people on the group. Renato Alarcon represents from Mayo, a very interesting area of personality disorders, and particularly has been focused on cross-cultural issues. Carl Bell has helped with that as well. Donna Bender from Tucson has been very interested in the levels of severity. Leanna Clark and Bob Kruger have been very expert in trait psychology and factor analytic work and personality, and each of them has developed an assessment instrument. John Lively from Vancouver, but likewise, has been very active. Les Morey is from Texas A&M, has developed a personality disorder inventory that is widely used. Larry Siever from Mount Sinai, particularly interested in schizotypal. Penrol Verhoel from the Netherlands is our international member. Second one, Liz, is from Canada. So that's the work group. Lisley and Verhoel later, after toward the end of a line, withdrew from the committee. Verhoel had trouble really participating from the Netherlands, and they were very actively involved for most of the process. So we were given our challenge. Our effort was to try to come up with a dimensional consensus that had been difficult in the field. But we took our charges seriously, and it was not easy. For one thing, the factor analytic trait psychology research is extensive, but the terms of trait psychology are often not terribly familiar to clinicians and are not as widely used in clinical circles, but are more often well-known in college and graduate school psychology courses. And so that was a translational problem to really help people get familiar with these terms. And then this is speculative on our part, but we did feel that there was a lot of concern about ongoing research and worry that too radical a set of changes might really complicate the research continuity, and we were sensitive to that as well. So it was not a straightforward task. So at this point, now let me move and describe to you what the model looks like that we have developed. And this is a model that was developed as a final consensus. One of the things we did was to come to a somewhat different general definition of the personality disorder. It's called general criteria for personality disorder. DSM-IV has this as well, but it's a different version in DSM-IV. That was the first DSM edition that did present a general defining set of criteria to define the personality disorders. There's a lot of research that is pretty prevalent and pretty persuasive that really identifies the essential features of personality disorder being two main things. One is moderate or greater impairment in personality functioning and a set of pathological personality traits. And personality functioning is subdivided into two things, a sense of self and a capacity for interpersonal relations. And what's shown on this slide, number 19, is that we have two subcategories under a sense of self, and this text on this slide describes what would be a way to describe normal sense of identity and self-direction and normal interpersonal capacity. So what you see is that normally one should have a good sense of identity, be able to experience oneself as unique, with clear boundaries between yourself and others, with stability of self-esteem, capacity for a range of emotional experiences, and being very good at directing yourself, being able to come up with meaningful short-term goals and also long-term life goals and career goals, and have a set of standards of behavior and a capacity to self-reflect. Interpersonally, we believe there are two main components of that. One is empathy, capacity to really appreciate others' experiences, in a sense to see things through someone else's eyes and have empathy with that other person. And then a capacity for a mutually gratifying, intimate set of relationships over time. So these are definitions that we believe really capture the essence of personality functioning and an effort to describe it in the normal sense. Then, if we're talking about pathology, we have two criteria in general. One is what we call criterion A, which is moderate or greater impairment in personality functioning, manifest by characteristic difficulties in two or more of the following four areas. And these are the four that I just showed you on the previous slide. Sense of identity, sense of self-direction. Those are both in the sense of self, and empathy and intimacy, which have to do with interpersonal relationships. And then there will be a way that you will be given a level of impairment scale. And we actually did quite a number of statistical analyses that led us to conclude that the appropriate threshold for defining the presence of a personality disorder was at the moderate or greater level of impairment. And so that is the requirement in this system, that there be moderate or greater impairment. If you look back at DSM-4 that we looked at a little while ago, and you have 5 out of 9 criteria, for example, for borderline, there were no data that led to really the establishment of that threshold or the same threshold for the one for any of the other disorders. They were fairly arbitrary. And we've tried to set the thresholds in this system based on analyses of extensive data. Criterion B will be patterns of pathological personality traits. And the trait domains are these five. I'm on slide 22 now. And the words are negative affectivity, detachment, antagonism, disinhibition, and psychoticism. Again, you'll see that these are not words that are common in our parlance in clinical work, but these are very common within the world of personality studies and personality traits. So let me get back to that in a minute, and then I'll show you really what each of those refers to. But just to back up, I'm now going back to show you that we're talking about the general criteria. So the general criteria are criterion A, that there are significant impairments that are at the moderate or greater level in 2 out of 4 of these conditions. In addition, there are pathological personality traits in at least one of these trait domains. Then in addition, and this mirrors in some way the general defining criteria in DSM-4, the impairments in personality functioning and trait expression are relatively inflexible and pervasive across a broad range of personal and social situations, not just specifically in one set of atypical circumstances. They also are relatively stable across time, with onset that can be traced back at least to adolescence or early adulthood. I will interject here that some people have misinterpreted DSM-4 to imply that one cannot make a personality disorder diagnosis unless the person is 18 years old or older. DSM-4 doesn't actually say that, but it does indicate that that's a guideline. And yet you are certainly given permission to make the diagnosis earlier, but many people have interpreted that to mean that you don't make the diagnosis earlier. That 18 age stipulation will not be in DSM-5 except for one personality disorder, and that's antisocial, where it will be listed as age 18. And that's for complicated forensic reasons more than for natural development of the disorder reasons. Still with the general definition, the impairments are also not better explained by another mental disorder, and they're not better explained by the secondary effect of either a substance use problem or severe injury such as a stroke or head trauma. In addition, they're not better understood as the result of an individual's developmental stage or sociocultural environment. So many of those are similar to the DSM-4 general criteria. So the DSM-5 proposal suggests that we have 6 specified personality disorders called antisocial. These are all in the book, and they're just listed alphabetically here rather than in the cluster system, because that will not be part of this particular model. So the 6 that would be listed are shown here: antisocial, avoidant, borderline, narcissistic, obsessive-compulsive, and schizotypal. What's missing from the DSM-4 list is paranoid, schizoid, histrionic, dependent, and the other six of these that are listed. So those four are not listed here, but they would be reclassified under this last item on this slide, which is called Personality Disorder Trait Specified. In many ways, this is, I think, a much better way to structure things, because it's the new version of what in DSM-4 would be called PDNOS, Personality Disorder Not Otherwise Specified. I can tell you, by the way, that if you go into a chart review in most clinics or hospitals, the most common personality disorder that will be listed on Axis 2 is not in the book. It's one called Deferred. And that's really very commonly utilized. The problem is that it's not very often undeferred later. The second most common is personality disorder NOS. And that's used very frequently, but it's not used correctly much of the time. Because if it's used correctly, it's supposed to mean that you have already studied all 10 DSM-4 personality disorders, evaluated the patient, and concluded that the patient has the general defining characteristics of a personality disorder, but does not meet threshold for any of the 10 disorders, and therefore is PDNOS. Most people use that to mean mixed, which isn't really what it's supposed to mean. Personality disorder trait specified is shown on this next slide. And criterion A is exactly the same, and that is that there's moderate or greater impairment by characteristic difficulties in two of these four areas. And criterion B is that one or more pathological trait domains or specific trait facets is present. So if you had what in DSM-4 might be diagnosed, someone diagnosed with, let's say, paranoid personality disorder, you would diagnose in DSM-5 using this system that person as personality disorder trait specified with prominent characteristics of paranoid traits. Likewise for dependent or histrionic or schizoid. These trait domains I will now unpack a little for you and show you the trait. It's called trait facets. Or the particular subcategories under each trait domain. And each trait domain is actually a pole of a bipolar spectrum. So negative affectivity means frequent and intense experiences of high levels of a wide range of negative emotions, such as anxiety, depression, guilt and shame, worry, anger, and behavior that follows from those traits, such as the self-injurious behavior that we can see in borderline patients, or interpersonal complications. The polar opposite of negative affectivity is emotional stability, and that would move from the pathology to the health end of the bipolar spectrum. Under the pathological trait domain, you can see the list of things that are emotional lability, anxiousness, separation insecurity, submissiveness, hostility, perseveration, depressivity, suspiciousness, and restricted affectivity. And there have been a lot of work that's been done in the psychology study that has clarified that these are repeating traits that are very common in the population. I won't go through every one. You've got this material and can go back to it and look at it, and I won't use our time now to go through each one of these other than to point out just the broad features. Detachment is the opposite of extroversion. Detachment is like disconnectedness, and withdrawal from interpersonal interactions, really restricted affect, and difficulty with pleasure and enjoying other people. I will insert here just an editorial comment and say this is the kind of behavior that at least by secondhand descriptions in the perpetrator of the tragic situation in Connecticut has been one aspect of how he has been described. And I am only saying that as a general way of thinking, because that's not been confirmed in terms of good information yet. But under this, you can see there are things like avoiding intimacy. Some of these repeat themselves because they are characteristic of several different domains, such as depressivity and restricted affectivity. Antagonism is a trait domain that is characterized by callous antipathy toward others, lack of awareness of others' needs or feelings, lack of interest in others' feelings, and a willingness or even readiness to use others in their own self-enhancement. Things like manipulativeness, grandiosity, callousness, and hostility. This inhibition is the opposite of conscientiousness, and here this involves really disregard for future consequences, impulsive behavior, a tendency to be distracted and to take risks and not be particularly organized or perfectionistic. And finally, psychoticism, the opposite of lucidity or clear clarity in your cognition, involves unusual beliefs and experiences, eccentricity, and sometimes perceptual distortion. So let me now apply some of those trait facets and trait domains, using borderline as an example. So for borderline in DSM-5, using this system, the typical features are stated first, and this is true for each of the six identified disorders. For borderline, typical features are instability of self-image, personal goals, and interpersonal relationships, and affects, accompanied by impulsivity, risk-taking, and or hostility. And characteristic difficulties are apparent in the areas we already know about, such as self-direction, identity, empathy, and or intimacy. And then the pathological traits are tailored in each of these disorders to correspond with the pathology that is characteristic of each disorder. So for borderline, there will be marked or moderate or greater difficulties in these four already familiar areas that define criterion A. But the text is written in here. So for identity, for a borderline, you will see a markedly impoverished, poorly developed or unstable self-image, excessive self-criticism, feelings of emptiness, dissociative states under stress. I'm going to show you in a minute visually how this correlates with DSM-4, but this should begin to sound familiar to you, because what we've done is really reconfigure the way these DSM-4 criteria are listed so that they can be much more systematically understood as defining features in these four areas and then typical pathological traits, rather than focusing on a mix of traits and behaviors that derive from the traits. Self-direction is difficult, instability in goals and values and career plans, compromise in number three, ability to recognize the feelings and needs of others, perceptions of others as biased toward negative attributes, and intense, unstable, and conflicted close relationships, mistrust, neediness, anxious preoccupation, with real or imagined abandonment. Again, many of these are terms very familiar that are similar to the criteria in DSM-4, but are organized in this way. Then, for borderline, and we've set the actual thresholds for the diagnosis based on analysis of data rather than an arbitrary threshold. So four or more of the following seven pathological traits need to be present, but in addition, at least one of those must be from number 5, 6, or 7 below. So the first pathological trait is emotional lability, and that's an aspect of that trait domain, negative affectivity. And here you've got unstable emotional experiences, frequent mood changes, and the like. Number two is anxiousness, also an aspect of the trait domain negative affectivity. And lots of anxiety, nervousness, apprehension. Number three, again, a function of negative affectivity is this separation insecurity or separation anxiety. Number four is depressivity, also an aspect of negative affectivity. And this is repeated feelings of depression and hopelessness, shame, and inferior feelings. And that can lead then to thoughts of suicide and suicidal behavior. Then impulsivity is an aspect of the trait domain of disinhibition. And finally, risk-taking, another aspect of disinhibition. And then the last one, number seven, hostility, an aspect of antagonism. This is the one that would be indicated for as intense and persistent anger. So that's the way the new model would look for borderline. If you put those side by side, and I won't belabor this, but you can look at this at your leisure. I put this on here just so that you can see in a crosswalk the DSM-4 criteria on the right side and the DSM-5 on the left, and see where in our reconfiguration you would find the same things that are in DSM-4. And those are really organized just so that you can see the DSM-5 criteria in the sequence they will look like in the book, and then what the DSM-4 criteria that correspond to those criteria are, and those are shown on the right. Okay, let me now just quickly, allowing time for discussion, talk about a little bit of recent and new data. First of all, you know that DSM-4 defined borderline personality is not stable over time, unlike the generic definition. And if you try to decide how do you determine what a remission is in borderline, you would say, well, a remission is less than the 5 required criteria. We didn't feel in a large multi-center NIMH-sponsored study over many years that that was strong enough. So we set the threshold very high. We said you have to have no more than 2 criteria for 1 solid year, for 12 consecutive months. And if you do that, and this is in an article in the Archives of General Psychiatry with Gunderson as the first author, you find a remarkable remission. 85% of patients with DSM-4 defined personality disorder called borderline remit, defined by no more than 2 criteria for 12 consecutive months. If, on the other hand, you look at functioning, the bottom blue line on this particular chart is the borderline sample, and these patients do improve, but the improvement in functioning is not as quick. And a new study that's done by the same collaborative group that's in PrEP is shown on this slide, number 50, which shows that, in fact, over those 10 years, the stability was in the range of 0.6 to 0.9, and that's pretty good for traits, but only 0.25 to 0.65 for the DSM-4-defined disorders. So the traits are much more consistent and stable as defining features of the personality disorders than the criteria in DSM-4. We looked then at clinical usefulness of the DSM-5 criteria. We looked at it in terms of a study that our work group did led by Les Morey. And in this study, they found that in looking at 334 clinicians, in 14 out of 18 comparisons, DSM-5 was perceived as more clinically useful than DSM-4 in terms of ease of use, communication of information, and comprehensiveness in describing pathology as well as treatment planning. It also found that DSM-5 was empirically demonstrated to be more strongly related to clinical decision-making than DSM-4. So this was interesting to observe because these were new ways of thinking about it, but clinicians actually responded very positively. They were asked to mark all criteria that applied to real patients in their practice from randomized list of all DSM-4 criteria and DSM-5 criteria. And the correlations between the endorsed criteria were very high in the 0.7, 0.8 range. We also have field trials data. And in the field trials, in the academic routine clinical practice field trials, over 80% of clinicians in both of them found the new criteria moderately to extremely useful compared to DSM-4. A larger portion of those that said they found it extremely useful was observed in those from routine clinical practice. And they actually rated it much more useful than things like schizophrenia spectrum, substance use, even though the personality disorder system was far more radically changed than these other newer proposals. These are color charts that show those ratings, and the one bar chart on toward the right with a star on it is the personality disorder. This is from the academic field trials, and the three top colors reflect either moderately, very, or extremely useful compared to DSM-4. And you can see that a very strong percentage of the responses found the personality disorder proposal to be a preferred model. And this was also true for the routine clinical practice group. We also did look at test-retest reliability, and borderline personality disorder had good pooled test-retest reliability comparable to bipolar 1, better than schizophrenia, better than mild neurocognitive disorder, and better by a lot than major depressive disorders. We had, along the way, a lot of complexity to the process. We submitted our field trial protocol to the task force because we wanted to compare DSM-5 with DSM-4. But the task force decided to use the reliability standard protocol for all work groups instead. We submitted that same field trial protocol as a grant to NIMH. We got a great score, actually got a priority score of 20 at a time when NIMH was funding up to, and that was about at the 10th percentile, at a time when it was funding up to the 15th to the 20th percentile. And Tom Insel commented, and the reviewers actually, in the pink sheet, commented that it was a highly meritorious study that should be done, but this was something NIMH shouldn't fund, but rather the APA should fund. It wasn't funded, and we hadn't been able to get the APA to do it, so that's what led to the Mori and the group doing it ourselves, and those are the data I already showed you. There was a midstream revision from a prototype model that we first proposed, and that sort of delayed some of the field trial data. We then submitted the summary proposal to the scientific review committee, the clinical and public health committee, the task force, the assembly committee, and the task force then reviewed the entire proposal after receiving the evaluations by the peer review groups, and the task force approved the proposal. Frequently heard concerns, however, were that it's too complicated and clinicians won't use it. If you do a reality check, in fact, DSM-5 was proposing using 25 traits, and if you did DSM-4 right, there actually are 94 criteria that you have to evaluate, and a 43% reduction in the number of things you have to think about if you compare the two side by side. What people, in my opinion, mean when they say it's more complicated, they say it's more complicated than what I do now, not than DSM-4. And what I do now is use a kind of a prototype intuitive model of quickly getting a sense of whether a patient has, let's say, borderline personality disorder, and that diagnosis is then explored, but all 10 are not explored in an equivalent fashion. The final proposal was presented, and I presented it to the task force in October, and the task force strongly and unanimously endorsed and approved the proposal. However, the review groups continued to have lots of concerns that it was too complex and unfamiliar. They objected to, or were concerned about, the objections that had been loudly and vocally published in the field by some very influential leaders in the field. And the Board of Trustees, in the end, voted to approve the personality proposal only for Section 3, which is the DSM-5 component that's comparable to the appendix DSM-4, but not Section 2. I will say that I was personally very disappointed in this decision and made that clear to the board that that was the decision of the board, and as a member of the board, I support the decision of the board, even though personally I don't, I was disappointed that that was the decision. But I'm glad that it is in DSM-5. Here's what the table of contents looks like in DSM-5. Section 1 will be really a background section and a guideline section on how to use it. Section 2 will include these chapters. Some of them are a little different than DSM-4. So, for example, bipolar is in a separate chapter from depression. Obsessive compulsive is in a separate chapter from the anxiety disorders, and trauma and PTSD is in a chapter of its own. Personality disorders will be the 18th chapter. The section in Section 2 with the codes will be virtually identical to the categorical system in DSM-4, which will not be changed. And that's what will be officially used in DSM-5. But DSM-5 includes Section 3, which has alternatives, the alternative model number 3 on this slide, I'm in slide 69. Which is available then for people who are interested to try it on to size and use it and study it. And so that's where we are. So 5 is now a work that's complete. DSM-5 was changed from a Roman numeral to an algebraic in order to then have DSM-5.1, 5.2, and not have to wait for another 20 years until we got a new DSM. So hopefully this will be what's called a living document, and we'll be able to move the DSM-5 Section 3 proposal that I've just gone over with you online sooner than another decade. So thank you very much, and I'll stop at that point. We'll turn it over to either Jim, if you're on, or Perry.
Jim, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, good. Do you, John, I thought that was absolutely wonderful, fabulous. I mean, so much information in this. But we'll let Jim pose the questions to you.
Okay.
Yeah, there are some questions that came up, John. Do you think that this new scheme will lead to greater acceptance among clinicians and researchers of personality disorders in general and borderline and specifically? As you know, people criticize the access to placement as kind of minimizing and backrooming personality disorders and borderline.
Jim, and whoever asked the question, it's a very complicated one. First of all, the DSM-5 will not be multi-axial, and many people view that as an advantage. I believe that if we did still have the multi-axial system, that there is absolutely no conceptual justification to keep the personality disorders in a different section. So if we did have multi-axial, the personality disorders would be in Axis 1. One of the side benefits of having the personality disorders in Axis 2 now is that you're required to think about them and make a diagnosis. That will not be the case in DSM-5. So how that will make a difference, I don't know. And I also can't really predict whether this system will lead to a greater attention clinically to the personality disorders or not. It will need to be, it becomes familiar. It's got new language that clinicians will need to learn, but once it becomes officially required in the main body of the manual, then that will be required for clinicians to use. I personally was unfamiliar with this personality trait area in the beginning of my work on the work group, and have become very persuaded by it, and I find it's very helpful in helping me organize how to think about personality disorders using these trait domains, and it really helps me think about it, and I find that it's enormously preferable to the kind of effort to memorize the checklist of criteria, each one different from the other. In DSM-4. So I think the people who are willing, and maybe in the end when it's required to use this new system, that in the end they will feel much that it works much better and it should help.
What kind of research work do we need on the personality trait assessment to help clinicians do this assessment in a more time efficient but accurate way, and to have psychometric validity?
Well, there's a whole lot that's already been done. There are extensive publications. There are two publications in the Journal of Personality Assessment that are just out, which were the top two publications cited in the whole journal for the entire last year. And those are by members of the work group, as well as other colleagues. Bob Kruger has published the personality inventory using these 25 trait facets and these five trait domains. There's an assessment instrument that's already been developed for that actually the APA owns the copyright of. It's been studied and published. So there is a fairly extensive literature, and that will be available in the reference component of Section 3 when it comes out in DSM. In the October issue of the Journal of Personality Disorders, there are many papers that are already looking at this model. So there are large groups or a number of groups that have already been studying this, and the validation of this particular approach has already been pretty firmly established.
That sounds good and very reassuring. What do you see happening by the time we get to DSM-6?
I don't know when that's going to be, but I think we're going to be first challenged to set up a good structure to guide us in terms of what kind of new data and progress needs to occur to trigger incorporating changes into a next edition. And the next one will be 5.1, and how many versions after that, such as 5.2 and 5.3, will be developed before there's a decision to do a DSM-6. I just don't know, and I couldn't really predict about that, Jim.
Okay, we're running out of time. Maybe in the spring we can get back to this for other questions and discussions after tapping Bob Kruger and others to really bring people up to speed on this good work. I had trouble getting in. I hope other people didn't have it. And just in our last minute, I'd just like to mention what a great long-term worker and supporter of borderline personality disorder you've been from the APA task force with that report on guidelines for assessing and treating borderline. That was the longest and an extraordinarily thorough guideline document that really gave, I think, a big boost to the disorder. Your graciousness and in spite of your very hectic schedule of being very supportive of efforts to brief congressional staff and meeting with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration people and other ways. And I guess I'd also just like to personally acknowledge and let people know appreciation that I know I'm awed not only by your long-term work and commitment but to borderline, but by the willingness of you here to give time to the call-in. And it's such an honor, I think, for us to have you on the call-in and with the subsequent discussion on Wednesday evening. The thing I'd like to mention is that it's not just a personal opinion. John Oldham has been recognized by other administrators in psychiatry, in terms of his positions at the New York Psychiatric Institute and Psychiatry Department of South Carolina, and now at manager within the field of psychiatry by his election as president of the association, a service that he has just completed. So that's my personal thanks, but I think on behalf of everybody, we really appreciate your long-term effort on behalf of the disorder and support of it.
And well, thank you, Jan. Let me just mutually return the compliment, because I really appreciate all of your good work and your support, and also, Perry, yours and NEABPD. We need your organization, and it does a really wonderful job of helping people understand this disorder, which is what's the main goal that we all have.
Well, thank you, and thank you to both of you, because it's really thanks to both of you that NEABPD has been able to do the work that it's been doing. Both of you have been incredibly supportive to us, and we are so appreciative. We look forward to the call on Wednesday. Those of you who are on the call now, it's a work in progress. It was something we thought of several hours ago, and John and Jim have graciously offered to make something happen on Wednesday evening from 8 to 9. So please look out for an e-blast that we'll send you, and we hope to put something together that will help people with what's happened this past week in Connecticut. So Jim or John, I don't know if you want to say anything more about that right now.
Well, no, we'll just be, that's going to be less formal. It won't be a slide PowerPoint presentation, but we'll have a chance to have a discussion about this really tragic situation, and then be glad to have some questions and discussion.
Okay, thank you, and thank you to everyone on the call. Have a good
okay.
night.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.